From the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, this is Voices of Public Intellectuals. I'm your host, Florence Ladd. This week's program features Decima Williams, founder of the Grenada Education and Development Program and former co-chair of Mass Action for Women. Professor Williams is speaking on women's leadership and the politics of transformation, cases from around the Caribbean and South Africa. Here to introduce Professor Williams is Dr. Tamar March, Dean of Educational Programs.
Good evening and welcome to the second of Feminisms and the Practice of Democracy. I welcome you on behalf of the Graduate Consortium in Women's Studies and the Radcliffe Seminars. These lectures illustrate the diversity of positions and strengths that women bring to the public discourse on matters that concern the nature of democracy and the varieties of its practices. It is truly a privilege to introduce Decima Williams, Professor of Sociology at Brandeis University. Professor Williams' teaching and research interests focus on issues surrounding social development, social inequality, and change. She is the founder of the Grenada Education and Development Program, GRENED, which promotes education in Grenada as a catalyst for empowerment and change. She co-founded Haiti Women in 1991, an organization created to support Haitian women during the turbulence occasioned by the 1991 military coup and maintained, unfortunately, for years thereafter. Dr. Williams served as Grenada's special envoy to UNESCO's World Conference on Culture in 1982 and was a delegate to the World Summit on Social Development in Copenhagen in 1995. She is vice president of Oxfam America, and from 1995 to 1999, she co-chaired the Massachusetts Action for Women, which was launched to implement the 1995 Beijing Platform for Action of the Fourth World Conference on Women. Decima Williams holds a PhD in international relations from the American University in Washington, D.C. In 1991, she was a Bunting Peace Fellow at Radcliffe and worked on a project entitled Achieving Sovereignty Under Conditions of Hegemony. The title of her lecture tonight is also the title of her current research project, Women's Leadership and the Politics of Transformation, Cases from Around the Caribbean and South Africa. Welcome back to Radcliffe, Decima Williams.
Thank you, Dean Tamara Marsh, for this invitation to be here, for your warm introduction, for your planning, and for your expectations. I see in the audience here really a wonderful collection of my old friends, and it warms my heart and gives me great trepidation simultaneously. As quoted in a recent issue of the Radcliffe Journal, an African-American television writer had this to say, and I quote, "I worry," she said, "that in all the excitement over the new technologies, we too often undervalue the human drama, which is the basis of good storytelling. If we ignore this crucial element, we will not succeed." End of quote. I believe that the human drama of women's struggle for leadership power and for improving the conditions of women, often the former, is a catalyst to the latter, as well as for society and the work that they do for the world, forms a basis for my storytelling tonight. And can storytelling be public intellectualism? My vivid memories of public storytelling, apart from the Catholic priest whom I faced every Sunday morning, are of my father and his friends after work, this hearty bunch of farmers telling and retelling some of their truths, vivacious jokes, to which bands of laughter would follow a long, nuanced oration by one of them. Along with them, my own mouth would open, my expressions dance and change as the story developed, and then, as if on cue, I would break into laughter with them, whether I understood it or not, whether I was supposed to laugh at the story or not, as a child. But I learned from them the public voice. Later, one among them rose up, a robust baker, with an even more robust voice and a tale that was far from singular, a tale that was so woven that nothing could be said about it that was linear. It was his storytelling that took me across the world as a child when we go to listen to him in his public oration. And I clearly and distinctly remember being transported to places like Asia Minor and Africa with the local fairy tales and storytelling of Grenville. Among my mother and her many sisters, their storytelling took place mainly on the beach amid a plentitude of children, food, family warmth, and long lapses of getting together, since some of them lived in Trinidad and came back to Grenada only infrequently. Their storytellings were not all joyous, but even the sad ones lent themselves to the most plentiful item of the day, laughter. I could hear all that laughter now. Those were my first public intellectuals, analyzing their children's behavior, their spouses' good or bad judgment in business, the politics of the day, the inter-family wrangling. They taught me the sharing of the story is an important way to bear it, bitter or sweet, certain or uncertain. I take up some of this tradition here tonight, the sweet and the bitter, the certain and the uncertain. I ask tonight whether women's leadership can contribute to the politics of transformation in a way that is meaningful for us in this era. Worldwide, gender inequalities continue to frame wider social, cultural, economic, and political inequalities. The picture has improved. Women have made progress, as we gathered here in this Radcliffe Institute attest to. We are among the degreed 20th century female breed. We couple that with another reality, that impoverished women in impoverished countries and communities make up the majorities of the disinherited and remain at or very near the bottom or the edge of society. Consider that of the 900 million illiterates in the world, 65% are female. Consider that of the 130 million out-of-school dropouts, 70% are female. Consider that of the 100 million primary school dropouts, 66% are female. Consider that of the 1.3 billion poor, many living, according to the United Nations, below with less than a dollar a day, 70% are women and their dependents, children, the elderly, the sick. And consider that women performed 66% of the unpaid work of the world. But consider also that less than 2% of the executives worldwide are women, or that our parliaments worldwide are somewhere in the vicinity of only 10% female, and our managers in business, in the state sector, combine to only 14% worldwide. You know the story. I have called it elsewhere the reality of gendered global apartheid. We are congested where there is powerlessness, and we are overwhelmingly absent where there is power. It's often said that we have no democratic society in the world, if by democracy we mean the equal sharing of power between the classes, the races, the ethnicities, and the sexes. According to the United Nations 1994 report, updated in the same vicinity over the last 5 years, if the standard is one for all men, for women, the attainment of power on a gender development index reaches its highest point in Sweden, 0.919%. And among the lowest would be in the Caribbean's Haiti, 0.354%, or in Jamaica, 0.7%. Here in the United States, 0.9%. We assume that we're not doing so badly. More women than ever before have risen and are continuing to rise at or near the top of political power in ever larger numbers in every country of the world. Women are rising up. What is and what can be, therefore, the relationship between these two realities? Namely, increasing number of but few women with power and large numbers of other women experiencing social exclusions. Is there, ought there, to be any relation between these two communities? On July 21, 1960, Sirimavo Dias Bandaranaike was sworn into office as the elected prime minister of then Ceylon. As the first and at the time the only woman to hold the title of head of government, she made history. 36 years later, she continues to hold office and to make history. She first served as prime minister from 1960 to 1966, and again 1970 to 1977. Following her victory at the polls in 1994, Mrs. Bandaranaike has returned to the post of prime minister for a third time. This time, she was appointed by the woman who currently serves as head of state, the president in Sri Lanka, none other than President Chandrika Bandaranaike Kumaratunga, Sirimavo's daughter and a stalwart politician in her own right. Once a lone political heroine since 1994, Prime Minister Bandaranaike and her daughter are together the only two women to ever simultaneously hold the top executive posts in any country. And if anybody's interested in this research, I'd love to accompany you to interview them. Now, on the other side of the world, in the Caribbean, another lone heroine made her appearance at the helm of government 20 years exactly to the day after pioneer Bandaranaike, Dame Mary Eugenia Charles of Dominica, who was thrice consecutively elected and served as prime minister from 1980 to 1995. Interestingly, Dame Eugenia, a Canadian-trained lawyer, rose to office on her own political strength, having been the co-founder of a political party and member of a family in which no male or female politician was active, unlike the Bandaranaikes, who replaced both their assassinated husbands. On leaving office, former Prime Minister Charles was the longest consecutive serving female head of government. Throughout Asia, the Caribbean, and indeed throughout the world of post-colonial developing societies, women have been emerging to provide political leadership to their nations. How they have come to office, their style of leadership, and why they have emerged in larger numbers in the Southern Hemisphere than in the Anglo-American sphere, these have been intriguing questions for scholars and political observers alike. All questions continue, and the main question that has preoccupied analysts is, you know, how have they come to office? Janet Jagan was elected Prime Minister of the South American Caribbean Republic of Guyana immediately following the sudden death of her husband in 1997. And still here in the Americas, in Panama, just a few months ago, Mireya Moscoso was elected President earlier in 1999. though her husband had been president 22 years earlier, and he had been dead for 10 years, the political campaign and her own vision were still seen through her widowhood. And there are other women positioned, Megawati Suparakunga of Indonesia, who is now the vice president, is often seen as a stalwart politician, but a politician whose father is the father of the nation. What I'm suggesting is that this business of getting access to political power over the last 30 years for women have had two strands. Either the lone heroine who comes up on the basis of male power, or she comes up as a politician, but it's still the lone heroine, this person who comes seemingly out of nowhere. But there are both numerical differences now and contextual diversities. And I want to enunciate maybe six or seven changes we've noticed. More women are running worldwide and contesting and holding top leadership posts in larger numbers and with much more political independence than before. For example, in the Philippines, 2-3 women have run after Cory Aquino for the presidency of the Philippines. One came in and contested and said she had actually won. In places all over the world, women are running for seats in parliament. I think that's a first change from the 60s and 70s. Secondly, more women are actually getting elected. While it's true that in parliament it's only 13% and it's well below the 30% that the UN has recommended, nevertheless, around the world, the numbers are increasing. I think in the US it's about 12%. Of course, in the Nordic and Scandinavian countries, it is in the vicinity of 30-40%, depending on which period we're looking at. A third feature is the fact that many women are present in cabinets, ministerial and sub-ministerial posts. It's not unusual to have women cabinet ministers in large numbers of countries. Here in the United States, Janet Reno and Madeleine Albright are currently our two cabinet ministers, and many deputy, Donna Shalala, thank you, and Alexis Herman, there we go. It's increasing, that's my point. A fourth feature is that political parties are wooing women in larger numbers and with some degree of aggression, whether it's conviction or convenience. The parties, I mean, listen to the results of the elections in Iran today. A fifth is that there's a plethora of non-governmental organizations and groups which have come into being in recent times. And of these, tens of thousands are fully or partially devoted to improving women's condition or more radical feminist objectives. A sixth development, there is the case of what I call informal female power, at or close to the seat of formal power. These are politically active spouses of chief executives who are quite influential, especially regarding women's rights and women's empowerment. And we can think of so many. Many of these women, in fact, then go on to become heads of state after their partners are assassinated. But aside from them, we can think of Winnie Mandela. We can think of Imelda Marcos. We can think of Hillary Clinton. All of these women, by the way, who then go on to run for political office themselves. A seventh feature of this new era is that often there is a mass women's movement or a smaller feminist gender equity organization playing its role in this pantheon. So that in sum, these developments portend to a larger spread of women in the civil state society complex. So that unlike 30 years ago, we now see, if we look broadly speaking, a larger array of women gathered close to power or exercising power. And what is the importance of this? What transformational potential do we see in this for our societies? In South Africa, I think we have been treated with some really exciting information and exposures of the South African women's reality for a long time. Their reality, as you know, has been intertwined with that of the struggle for democratic rule, more broadly speaking. White women in South Africa got the vote in 1930, colored and Indian women in 1983, black women in 1994. At the same time, each category of women also got the right to stand for public office. In 1987, 3.5% of the parliamentarians in South Africa were women, and you could figure who those were. In fact, there was only one in 1975. And then we had the elections of 94 and the change of political system, which then gave us the 24% of the parliament being female. And today it's just around 30%, one of the few countries in the world to attain the United Nations recommendation of a minimum of 30% of women in all decision-making places if we are to see a gender equity in decision-making and social transformation through women. Now, what I try to do is to map out this new field, as it were, from the experience of this lone heroine. And I think the record shows that as a force, this lone heroine accomplished little. And sometimes we are often chastised with that. Why do women want power when you look at Benazir Bhutto? Why do women want power when you look at the failings of women to really care for women, to transform society? I'm not sure. Maybe we could get back at it in Q&A. But I think even when we look at instances like the rule of Bhutto or Cory Aquino, and I'm among their sharpest critics, I think nonetheless we see some changes, but it's been limited and it hasn't reached this large mass of women at the bottom. And therefore the second model I'm observing that is unfolding now and I'm testing in the case particularly of South Africa is what I call the critical mass model, where, as I said, women are moving up in larger numbers vertically and horizontally in some of the leadership positions. And this is what we have seen in the case of South Africa. Now, you know the South African struggle for democratic rights, which culminated with the formal overthrow of apartheid, the coming into place of the Government of National Unity in 1994, which was a joint national party which had governed for 40 years, and the ANC, the National Liberation Movement, governing in alliance in those two critical years. Critical because of the major legal and policy transitions took place during that time. The new constitution was written then, the policy of reconciliation as a priority over economic development or social development, all of those programs were put in place. The profile of the women in the Caribbean from the point of view of public conditions and public access has always been held up as comparable to Scandinavia and not to sub-Saharan Africa. That is to say, more women in the Caribbean have been in public professional roles and more women have held public office relative to sub-Saharan Africa and certainly the Arab world. The statistic that we looked at before in terms of the gendered global apartheid visits South Africa but also parts of the Caribbean. Clearly, we are familiar with the distinction, for example, that one could make reluctantly between the social and economic conditions in rural or even in urban Haiti with that of, you know, middle-class English-speaking Caribbean, part of Spain, Levantine. I want to go back to post-Beijing because it is well agreed that the Fourth World Conference on Women gave this massive impetus to formal and informal explosion of women's power. I have said that it really represented an explosion from the base to the extent that women's political power has more or less been at the base of society. And that what we saw was really in the formal document, the Platform for Action, in the NGO forum, in the analysis that has come forward, and in the follow-up, that we've seen a real explosion from the base, and some of it has happened here in Massachusetts. I take that analysis to the Caribbean and then ask, what have been some of the outcomes? What is the need in the Caribbean? Among the many needs, I think the CAFRA, the Caribbean Association of Feminist Research in Action, one of these many relatively small feminist organizations of which I spoke earlier on, has indicated that among the more pressing problems for women, whether we're speaking of Suriname or Trinidad or Antigua, is domestic violence. Women have assumed more leadership roles in decision-making and management in the region, yet they are seriously underrepresented within the political parties and in senior ranks of government. While they are more than 50% of the population, by and large, and while about, in some places, up to 40-50% of our households are headed by women, the truth is domestic violence remains one of the greatest challenges and has not really been taken up in the legislative arena as forcefully as it should. But after Beijing, the Caribbean feminist and public policy community argued that mainstreaming gender as a framework for tackling those singular and larger problems was perhaps the most pressing tool that they could use for transforming women's condition. And what did mainstreaming gender mean? And where would it be undertaken? The CARICOM Secretariat, CARICOM being this organization of Caribbean nations, led the charge on behalf of governments, but with strong advocacy from the women's movement. And the movement was well represented, I wouldn't say excessively so, but clearly well represented in Beijing. So that mainstreaming gender equality as a public policy advocacy tool helped spotlight the inequities and helped women in the region to have the legitimacy to undertake the challenges coming out of Beijing. The ministerial level, for example, Portia Simpson in Jamaica and Billy Miller in Barbados, were among those who, in alliance with Jocelyn Dow with the NGO sector in Guyana and Hazel Brown with the Working Women's Organization in Trinidad, formed a common Caribbean voice in alliance with CAFRA to put the removal of violence against women on the agenda. Would that have occurred without the emerging critical mass of women's power in the Caribbean? My experience in 1995 suggests not, because until that became, although many of the Caribbean countries have signed the CEDAW Convention, although some of the legal reforms in the Caribbean have spoken about and have written into their annals the necessity of creating stronger legal tools for women who come to the court system seeking redress from violence, it isn't until 1995 that there was a serious response from the state. Secondly, the very low level of attainments overall of women in political spheres suggests that there's a relative weakness in the mass movement or in the ability of this critical mass to move from a mass to a consciousness to an action. And perhaps the most important challenge that we need to undertake in the region is a rewriting of the development model in which globalization has pitted women against women, state against people or nation, poor countries against larger ones, small banana producers against multinational corporations. In all of this, working women and poor women continue to experience exclusion in the economic sphere. And as I said, all women experience a large amount of domestic violence.
You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Decima Williams.